You are listening to 97.3 LPFM WRIR, and this is Open Source RVA. This week on WRIR's Weekly Audio News Digest, we'll speak with City Council President Charles Samuels of the 2nd District about the politics surrounding the baseball diamond and the mayor's campaign to reshape the city. We'll also talk with City Assessor Jim Hester and developer Louis Salomonsky about how some developers are using historic tax credits in some very creative ways. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
I'm Brittany Tracy, and here's the news. An ominous warning from international hacker collective Anonymous is warning Mayor Dwight C. Jones and Richmond City Council to steer clear of Shaco Bottom. In an email sent Wednesday morning to Jones, all members of City Council, and local media outlets, a writer indicating that they represent Anonymous calls out city leaders for yet another plan to move the city's baseball stadium to Shaco, saying city leaders' long history of working with developers and business leaders at the expense of Richmond's majority Black population will not be tolerated. The email arrived at Mayor Jones's Ask the Mayor email address, and when asked if the city planned to step up its internet security or report the incident to investigators, Mike Wallace, a city spokesman, indicated that the mayor's office was tailoring its response to the venue through which Anonymous chose to communicate. The city does not have a response to this communication, as no requests were made, Wallace said. Shaco Bottom has long been targeted as a potential new location for the city's baseball stadium, the Diamond, currently located on the Boulevard. The anonymous letter minces few words in calling Jones and other special interests the, quote, criminal capitalist class who are seeking to redevelop Shaco Bottom, quote, under the guise of growth and wealth. To read the full letter, go to rvaopensource.com. The Richmond City Auditor has found worse problems than originally reported by a WTVR investigative report last year that led to the exit of various people connected with social services and the city's foster care program, including then-Deputy City Administrative Officer Carolyn Graham. The new report reveals vastly inadequate case management practices throughout Richmond, including leaving children in dangerous or neglectful households. Additionally, Dalal documents widespread record mismanagement and more than 400 missing case files. The full audit report is set to be presented to the City Council Audit Committee on Monday at 1 p.m. In the immediate aftermath of the audit's release, the city announced the departure of both the director and deputy director of social services. Are you interested in earning your Master Backyard Chicken Keeper certification? With the recent backyard hen ordinance, approved by Richmond City Council in April, a newly above-ground interest in chicken care and coop construction is hitting the city in time for gardening season. On May 15th and 16th, the Gossamer Foundation will hold workshops at the William Byrd Community House to teach Richmond residents valuable skills in caring for their feathered friends through hands-on experiences and interactive discussions. Prospective chicken owners will learn how integrating chickens into their own backyard can benefit the whole community. Patricia Foreman and Lisa Dearden of the group Occupy Backyards will conduct the classes in the evenings of Wednesday, May 15th and Thursday, May 16th, and prepare students to become Master Backyard Chicken Keepers. More information is available at www.chickensandyou.com. Virginia's state capitol is getting some much-needed love after the past few weeks of brewing scandal. The circa 1800 building will be featured nationwide on Sunday, May 12th at 10 p.m. on the PBS program 10 Buildings That Changed America. The program features buildings that influenced U.S. history. In the case of our capitol, it was designed by Thomas Jefferson and served as the model for Washington, D.C.'s dominant Greek Revival architecture. The program airs locally on WCVE.
Whew. Former 5th District City Councilman Marty Jewell is mobilizing on behalf of Richmond schools and calling on the public to come to next Monday's 6 p.m. City Council meeting. Jewell hopes to rally 1,000 people to demand council increase funding to the long underachieving school district where fewer than 20% of graduates attend college.
Number one, we only give 19% of the total general fund budget to schools, where Chesterfield gives 41%. And RICO gives 37%, Hanover gives 39%. 19% is all we give to schools' local funding.
Jewell is seeking an additional $8 million in this year's budget, the same amount asked for in a recent letter sent by school board chairman Jeffrey Bourne to city council.
Richmond Public Schools is severely underfunded. And sadly, it's almost criminal that so many people in charge don't know it.
The new boy in the neighborhood lives downstairs, and it's understood he's there just to take good care of me, like he's one of the family. Charles in charge of our days and our nights.
As City Council President, Charles Samuels sets the agenda for Richmond's policymaking body. But one of the chief criticisms of that body, coming out of the first 4 years of the administration of Mayor Dwight C. Jones, is that City Council has little luck in setting the agenda for the city beyond its sometimes yawn-inducing twice-monthly meetings. Samuels took the helm of council in January, elected by his peers to succeed still-seated 4th District Councilwoman Kathy Graciano, and almost immediately found himself in the midst of big-time politics. He helped orchestrate the complex and landscape-altering deal to bring the Washington Redskins training camp to Richmond. That seeming success was clouded by public criticism of a perceived slight of city schools and by a later bulldozing of dozens of irreplaceable old-growth trees that he and other council members had been assured would remain. And there's the budget. Tight fiscal times mean tight budgets and making tough decisions on funding public services like police, fire, and schools. More immediately, there's the looming likelihood of yet another round of talks over redevelopment on Boulevard and in Shaco Bottom, and that pesky regional argument over baseball. All right, I'm with Charles Samuels. He is City Council President, obviously, and then also represents a district, I believe the second. And Charles, thanks for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I guess the first thing I have to ask is a reference to everybody's favorite cartoon, Phineas and Ferb. Aren't you a little young to be president of council?
Well, yes. Yes, I am. It's actually funny you say that. It looks like Manoli Lupasi and I are close to the same ages when we first were elected to council, first became president of council. I think I've gotten beat by a few months, but it looks like at least since 1950, I'm the youngest.
That probably helped a little bit too, getting onto the Democratic sample.
Oh, I think that was a big help to me. Absolutely.
You had some tough choices to make, and I guess some bumps in the road during your first term. You had things like the noise ordinance and some parking issues as well that were not popular, but you seem to have transcended those. Have you lived those down, do you think?
Well, I guess that's really up to the people to decide.
Well, you were reelected.
The first noise ordinance, I quite frankly took some bad advice and allowed a process to go through where I didn't actually draft it, but instead patroned a paper. And since then, I've been very careful to have much more of a hand in the actual crafting of the legislation instead of agreeing to put something forward.
Helpful being a lawyer in that sense, right?
It's very helpful. It's time-consuming, but very helpful.
So football, and some of your job on council is to take some of what the mayor is putting forward as ideas and make those things happen. Yep. So one of them was this football, the Redskins training camp. Some of the details of that deal seem not quite as originally presented by the mayor. The trees, for instance, which you and Chris Hilbert both were a little upset about. Chris, by the way, was on our show, of course, last week. And I guess those were gone, in to put it bluntly, the trees were gone in versions of the plan that apparently mattered. And, of course, there was a significant addition to the Science Museum. Were you given the facts to work with? And I guess if you were not, is that a problem?
We had made an agreement with the administration that some of the trees we understood were going to have to come down. It's very hard to have a football field with a big oak in the middle of it.
Right.
But it was our understanding that a little bit, about 2 acres on the western side would be left on, essentially untouched. Eventually there would be a city park there, but that it would not be raised before implementation of that part of the plan. But like you said, the Science Museum wanted everything moved over a little bit to the west, and it was not made clear at all that the trees would have to all come down.
Is that, I guess, in your opinion, is
it
that a problem?
It was infuriating. It was absolutely infuriating. And
what should happen, I guess? How do you fix these things? Should there be any sort of penalty
I don't remember. I think it was Napoleon that said it, never ascribe malice to what could be ascribed incompetence. And so I'm not saying that it was done on purpose, that we were purposely left in the dark or anything like that. I think there was a serious
miscommunication. Please don't take any other advice from Napoleon, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously. after last year. At any rate, I think that since then we've worked tirelessly to ensure there's better communication between the Economic Development Authority, the contractors, the administration, and council to ensure that we don't have any more mistakes like that.
This seems to be, I guess, I don't want to call it a pattern, but something of a common thread in a lot of what things come from the mayor's administration. They seem to deal in details. Facts have value. And the administration seems skilled at sort of spending that currency that it has when it feels that it, and not spending sometimes. How do you feel about that strategy?
Well, facts are stubborn things. I mean, it's very hard to get past a specific fact. And one of the things I think that we need to continue working on with the administration is making sure that the administration and council, even if they disagree, are playing with the same deck, dealing with the same set of facts.
Playing
the same game, even. And we're doing some things right now to help mandate that idea.
Such as?
Well, John Belisles and I have a paper in right now that requires any temporary reassignment of personnel or any temporary altering of the shape or the form of government.
And this would be as a result of administration's spokesperson trying to...
Yeah, part of it was the press officer situation. Part of it was sometime last year, several folks involved in parking in the administration were moved from finance to the Department of Public Works without any notice given to council. And so
the change would do what?
The change would mandate 15 days advanced written notice, and there is an exception for emergencies where if it's an imminent danger to health, safety, or life, then there's...
Clearly the mayor needs
yeah,
that.
Then you got to be able to do the work and then come back and let us know what you've done. And there's also a penalty, a civil fine of $100 a day assessed to the chief administrative officer for every day that he doesn't give us the notice as required. That way we stay in line with the charter, allowing them to make those changes, but we make sure that city council is not just in the know, but is aware of the situation before the get-go.
And it's a personal fine to the CAO.
It's a personal fine. No taxpayer money can be used to pay it.
All right. And then the next thing is, sports tourism. Sports tourism in general seems to loom rather large in Jones's overall strategy. We've got the bike race, and we've got, of course, the football, and the squirrels. But most analysts seem to indicate that economic development around things like baseball parks and football training camps is sort of a loser for the taxpayer, at least in a financial sense. Are there other less tangible reasons to support these sorts of projects? We talked a little bit about this also with Chris.
You know, there is a sense of pride, I think, that comes from living in a place that has great amenities and that has wonderful things to do. I think this summer there's something like 40 festivals, which is basically one almost every weekend.
Just places like Woodstock. It's amazing.
It's absolutely incredible. And I think that's something that, at least with family members of mine that live out of state or out of town, they realize when they come to Richmond, there's always something wonderful and fun to do.
Let's go back to the Boulevard, since that, as we were talking about a little bit before the program here, sort of the nexus of where things, economic development things, seem to be happening. How important is that going to be to the city? I guess it is a gateway, obviously.
The Boulevard, I think, is one of the most important areas or projects that we have going on right now. It's my district. And about 3 years ago now, maybe closer to four almost, I did a series of charrettes to ask people who live, work, or play on the Boulevard what they wanted to see. And it was amazing how much in common with each other folks' ideas were. They wanted to see the stadium on the Boulevard.
So they'd like to see baseball stay.
Baseball stay. And I'll tell you, that lines up pretty easily with what my constituents have said they wanted. Near unanimous support for baseball on the Boulevard. They want to see mixed-use development around the Boulevard. Mm-hmm. They would like to see, obviously, more retail on the Boulevard. My math, and I'm always scared that Politicheck or PolitiFact is going to who asked me about this. If
I don't
my
think they've
math,
taken notice of open source.
If my math is right, almost 1,000 new residential units will be coming online in Scott's Addition and just in that surrounding area between basically.
You don't sound off on that.
Where Newtown is and where basically Thompson is. Mm-hmm. That's a huge number of new folks. Even if each of those was only a one bedroom unit, that is still 1,000 people coming to that area of town. You know, our census numbers are really surpassing expectations. When we did the census, we had 2,000 and, just over 200,000 folks in the city, and we have almost 6,000 more than that now. I mean, it's absolutely incredible to watch the skyrocketing of our population. Part of it's that wonderful return to urban living.
It's those people in Goochland and Hanover that are...
and it's just incredible to see. With that comes a need to develop the Boulevard. We've already made the arrangements to start moving the school properties off the Boulevard, to move the city garage off the Boulevard. And now really the discussion is going to have to be, what should replace it? Should it be a diamond with mixed use surrounding it? I mean, we've got, like you said, the Redskins just around the corner on Lee Street. We've got the Science Museum, the Children's Museum right there.
You've got Ginter at the other end, Ginter.
You've got Louis Ginter at one end, Maymont at the south end. You have on the way the VMFA, the Historical Society. And it makes a lot of sense. Oh, and you also have the Sportsbacker Stadium, the nicest track and field
Now, is that
facility
in the way of some of this development?
It very well could be, depending on what's proposed.
Looks like valuable property.
It's valuable property, but it's a good use of that property right now on Hermitage.
Now, real quick, you go back to what you had just said about schools property and making the arrangements to move them off the Boulevard. It sounds like they're not necessarily ready to go. The Ash Center is something that they still see, or at least many people on the board, the school board, seem to see as an asset, in spite of... And they seem to be between a rock and a hard place. They've got about $1 million in repairs to HVAC, and right now in the mayor's proposed budget, he's not giving them enough to spend $10,000 per school, even on just basic necessities, roof repairs, and things like this. The capital budget is way underfunded. And obviously, with $500,000 in their capital budget and $1 million in needed repairs or alleged needed repairs with that HVAC, it seems like they're sort of held hostage on giving it away to the city. But it could be something for them that could be a money maker. Is there some way maybe that there might be a way to bring them on board with a project like this and still allow them to have an asset that maybe could turn around and become a cash positive for them?
I really think there is, and this is...
And they're cash neutral right now.
Sort of how I envision it. First of all, they have some storage on the Boulevard sites also. And that's all getting moved already. They've agreed to that. That's no problem. So that's all.
They've not yet surplused it back to the city. It remains their asset.
It remains their asset. However, thanks to the work of Chris Hilbert and Ellen Robertson and some other folks on council, we have put in a... ordinance that prohibits the kind of thing where the Bon Secours deal
with the West Hampton
West Hampton, with the Redskins site, and with the community hospital, so that in the future, no matter what, a lease or what have you, the value of the property has to be given to the schools, which is right. I mean, that was the intent of the original law, and we want to try to follow that intent in the spirit of the law, not just the black letter of it. So that was a good thing to do. And that will be very helpful to the school system as they surplus other properties back. it was my understanding that the Arthur Ashe Center, everybody kind of agrees it's past its prime by a significant number of years, and that it is going to be torn down.
Everybody agrees to that.
I'm not saying everybody agrees, so I say that's my understanding.
Yeah, I've heard some of that, and I've obviously have heard people say this is no longer really a good way to remember Arthur Ashe's name.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
And it does certainly need some work.
it needs work. I mean, when it was built, it was nice. Yeah, I ran track there in high school, but...
You were in high school then.
I used to run there, I guess, between about 91 and 94.
Exactly. This is a good ways ago.
And it's seen its best days come and go. And I think it's time to continue honoring Arthur Ashe, but not do it with a rundown building, but instead with something that we can really take pride in.
All right. Now, you've got 3.5 years left of this current arduous task that is your boulder to push uphill. Any priorities?
There's a couple of things that I think we all want to do. First of all, obviously, there's a excitement on city council and the school board about improving the schools. Everybody always talks about it, but we've really got a great school board right now. We've got a good city council anxious to help them, and I'm hopeful that that spirit of congeniality, that open communication will continue.
All right, and I've got to stop you because, of course, the mayor, and I meant to ask you this question earlier, the mayor has sort of insinuated himself into that process with potentially helping to select the school superintendent after Dr. Brandon finally steps down officially. Should you guys have some role in that? You are the purse strings. You control the money. Of course, we have an elected school board, but, again, much of the power, or at least where it's derived from, starts with you guys. Should you have a role?
Well, I'll tell you, I read the mayor's press release when Dr. Brandon announced that she would not be continuing on after July of this year. And the press release as a whole was very nice. It praised her work here and everything else. And it did say that he was happy to help. If they needed him, he would be happy to help. I don't know how big a role he actually intends on playing. I think that maybe that part of the press release being the only part that was actually used in the newspaper.
And parsed and diced and sliced.
I'm not here to defend him or to attack him, but I think he might have gotten a little bit of a bum rap for actually offering to help if anybody needed him. Here's a guy who was on the school board at one point. Here's a guy who was in the House of Delegates for 25 years and has had clashes and a good working relationship, depending on the time frame, mm-hmm. with the schools. And so I think that saying that he's going to take over the process or that he's trying to take over the process may not be really accurate. What I think he offered was, I have some experience. We had this Blue Ribbon Task Force on the schools. If you need help, we're here to help.
So how about you guys?
Well, I think the same offer is there. And Jeff Bourne and I have talked about this, but at the end of the day, my opinion is that it really is the school board elected to help take care of the schools. And city council's job is certainly to fund the schools with input from the school board as to what they need in their budget. But at the end of the day, I really do believe it's their responsibility. And again, happy to help any way I can, but I also don't want to step on their toes as they're looking to do their job.
All right. And I interrupted you. Did you have any other things that you'd like to sort of see coming forward in the next 3 years?
I'd like to continue working with the police, maintain the drop in crime that we've seen over the last 4 years. I mean, it's been amazing. One thing I'd really like to work on is helping with police, firefighters, et cetera, with their STEP program. Right now, with the salary freezes that have been in place for longer than I've been on council,
it's tough. There are people who
veterans
who are making
about the same as a new recruit. Right. And that's not only causes some problems with morale, but it also doesn't value the folks in a way that I think is appropriate. And I want to make sure that we do something to help them with that. Other than that, it's the quality of life issues. You know, it's you want to be safe in your home. You want to go to have a good school in your neighborhood. You want flat roads, flat sidewalks. Those are the kind of things that I think are really important.
So you're going to level the Seven Hills of Richmond over your...
But I'm going to leave all the trees.
Okay, good. As long as the trees are there. All right. Well, Charles Samuels, thank you for being with us today. And again, aren't you a little young to be council president?
Why, yes. Yes, I am.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Chris.
It's been great talking with you.
WRIR is sponsored by Secco Wine Bar, open every day from noon to midnight. Secco offers artisanal wines by the glass, craft beers, and house-made snacks, sandwiches, and small plates. 2933 West Carey Street at the corner of North Shepherd and Carytown. Broadcast of WRIR is made possible in part by Rostov's Coffee and Tea, 1618 West Main Street, now featuring home delivery everywhere in the city. Details on the web at rostovs.com.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you and 19 for me.
I'm Scott Bass, news editor of Style Weekly. The far-reaching impact of the city's great residential renaissance is everywhere. The Fan, Church Hill, Northside, Manchester. Neighborhoods once pockmarked by blight were redeveloped and revived, luring back to the urban core young professionals and couples who once eschewed the cookie-cutter suburban lifestyle. It all started in the 1970s with a little push from a new state law that encouraged homeowners and developers to fix up old buildings and houses. The idea was simple: encourage investment in less than desirable neighborhoods by giving homeowners and developers a tax break on fixer-uppers. If you put in a new kitchen or rebuilt the bathroom, or really did anything to significantly upgrade your home, the city would lock in the building's assessed value prior to construction. This would lead to significant savings on your tax bill. But something happened along the way. What started as a modest tax incentive program grew into something bigger. Restrictions on the size of the addition that would qualify were dropped. Large commercial buildings, such as the $60 million plus Riverside on the James condo and office towers on Browns Island, are almost completely off the tax rolls. How? Because it's attached to a small building in the back valued at no more than $500. In this week's issue of Style, we reported on yet another new twist to the program, the fact that developers have figured out that they can simply move a building from one end of the property to the other and qualify the entire project for the tax exemption. Developer Louis Salomonsky, in fact, is tapping into the abatement program on his new $24 million project at 18th and Carey Streets in Shaco Bottom by doing just that. He moved a small brick building from one end of the property to the other. Today, the city has $1.8 billion of real estate that's not taxed through the rehab program, which represents 9% of the city's real estate. That represents $22 million in uncollected tax revenue. Coupled with the city's other tax-exempt properties, churches, schools, government buildings, today more than 30% of the city's real estate is off the tax rolls. So the question is this: has the program outlived its usefulness, and is it time to scale it back? Today we have Jim Hester, Richmond City Assessor, who has been on the front lines of the battle with this development community for 6 or 7 years now. We also have one of the city's most active and creative developers, Louis Salomonsky himself, who was widely considered one of the most savvy real estate entrepreneurs in the city.
So Jim, let's start with you. Catch us up on what happened. You know, this program started small and modest in the 1970s, late 70s, and it grew into something much bigger. What happened in the mid-1990s to change the scope of this program?
The Virginia General Assembly passed enabling legislation in 1979, and I think after it was passed, Richmond City was probably the first locality to adopt by ordinance the information that was in the statute. And the initial thrush, and I'm just laying a background here because it takes us where we're at today, was to provide some type of incentive to people to preserve and restore historic buildings. And in the enactment, the restrictions that the General Assembly placed on the localities if they should choose to adopt the ordinance was fairly narrow restrictions. Almost immediately, the localities who had adopted it started asking for changes because they wanted to modify it for their own purposes. And I think one of the first things that happened was the requirement that the square footage could only be increased by 15% was changed to, I think, 30% to please some localities. And there were two or three other revisions to the statute until we got up to 1995. In 1995 is when the big change occurred. I think localities, specifically Richmond, realized that this ordinance that they had could be modified to be used as a major economic development driver in the city, and that's when we started seeing a lot of changes to the local ordinance.
So, Lewis, you argue that without the incentive program, much of the development that we've seen in Richmond over the last 20, 30 years, or maybe it's closer since the mid-90s, wouldn't have happened. But the length of the tax abatement was reduced from, I think, 15 years to 10 years in 2006. Is that correct, Jim?
In 2006, it was reduced from the 1995 level of 15 years down to 10 years. That was a change in the local ordinance by City Council, who felt like it was time to tighten up on the tenure of the abatement.
Right. And I guess my question for you is, if we can go from 15 years to 10 years and not see a real reduction in the construction of these properties through the abatement program, well, why couldn't we scale it back more? What's the rationale for keeping it as is?
Well, when they cut it back from 15 years to 10 years, it did stop some of the construction, because banks who were doing 10-year permanent loans allowed the reduction in the operational expense and the real estate taxes to increase the what's called NOI, net operating income, which measures how much money can be borrowed. And all construction is a contest of what can you borrow versus what can it cost, because neither public nor private people have enough cash to cover too much of the delta in the two numbers. When they cut it back from 15 years to 10 years, which effectively was only 7 years full boat, in other words, full deduction, the long-term lenders with 10-year balloons could no longer capitalize the profit of the operation or the net income of the real estate operation to give the larger loan. So that put a dent in a fair amount of developers. Notwithstanding that, though, still in your first 7 years, when you're trying to stabilize, absorb changes, mistakes, and whatever you have, it helps you and gives you more breathing room. So the banks do the loans now, assuming there is no abatement, but then will give you back credit for what's called a present-day value for that savings to allow you to have a modicum of additional cash. And that is life and death to small developers who haven't built up cash over the years. And also, in larger projects, which we're doing now, which don't qualify for historic tax credits, because the reason we haven't had new construction is because the historic tax credits have funded a lot of the construction cost, and new construction has a very difficult time competing with it. But now, the rents are getting slowly up. We're running out of buildings that qualify for the historic tax credits, and new construction is starting. But the construction cost is high because there's serious inflation in construction. And the general income of the citizens of Richmond is not climbing as fast as in the counties. That is a fact. It's a statistical fact. So in our particular situation, where we were doing a $24 million project, that savings helped make a very marginal project just barely be justified to be under construction. And I don't know in the real world whether the savings is really nearly as large as you mentioned in your article, but still it's a substantial amount of money under any circumstances. We are fortunate because we have many years of building up our operational profits, and we can borrow more easily than new developers, and we own the land free and clear, so we made it work. Had we not had the abatement, we definitely would not have built the project. We would have left it as a parking lot, and we would have pursued the historical buildings in Scott's Addition for our expansion. But the city is concerned that we have an enormous amount of low-income apartments and residents, and that's a fact. And the city needs a socioeconomic community of wealthier people living among poorer people. It's a form of economic diversity. And right now, the market is pretty flat in appealing to tenants who equal about 85% of median income. That is the vast majority of everybody in Chaco Slip and Chaco Bottom. That is probably 85% of that market. So the city is constantly pushing for us to do more luxury or more substantial apartments that will appeal to people at 100% of median income and or above it. Right now, we have a ghetto of people making between $30,000 and $50,000 a year, and we have a dearth of people making from $50,000 to $100,000 a year. And we need that higher level of education and employment to balance the city. So with that nudging, and because we are constantly lifting the bar because we can afford to, we went ahead with this particular large project with some reticence. The planning department was very cooperative with us and very zealous in supporting us in doing this, what I'm going to call, for lack of better words, a semi-luxury project that will appeal to people whose earnings will be in the, let's say, $60,000 to $90,000 a year range. Now, do we want Chaco Bottom to be more and more of the same? Do we want Manchester to be more and more of the same? And the answer is no. We need to lift the bar generally. And if whatever the machinations that give this abatement causes projects to be built that wouldn't be built otherwise, the city is getting something that they would not get otherwise. And that's been the general wisdom in the thinking of city council. Now, this Sunday, I toured the new homes that are selling like hotcakes out at Short Pump. They're selling townhouses and small homes between $400,000 and $500,000, 8 and 10 contracts a week. That is enormous. And there are hundreds of these things being built out there. There's nothing, anything like that happening in the city of Richmond. And also, the city gets very little money from sales tax. The only way you're going to get more sales tax is to have more people living in the city. So question, when do you cut off that pipeline? When do you squeeze and choke off the ability of a preponderance of housing in the city? I don't have the answer to it, but right now it is still a struggle with the city's high tax rate to compete with the county's lower tax rate and what is considered generally a safer and more desirable area in which to live with better schools, right, and with easier access to retail. We have a dilemma, and we're fighting an uphill battle.
So what happens 10 years from now? I mean, what happens 15 years from 1995 when you have projects that start to come offline that are now having to pay the full tax, owners of properties, and then you have these new projects coming on that don't have to pay that tax? Doesn't it create a cycle wherein you're potentially overbuilding in the market, or you're creating this glut potentially, and these properties wind up being vacant because they simply can't be competitive down the road.
I think when the abatement falls off, you're going to start having more litigation against the city's real estate assessor, demanding that the assessments be based upon the income of the project and not based on comparables that truly aren't relevant, for one. But number two, the city still, even with the problems, will enjoy an enormous windfall of additional income that they have never seen before. And if you put that together with the metamorphosis of minorities moving to the counties for better schools, the empty nesters, both older and younger, moving into the city with no children, and the decline in the school system, you will eventually see the city's tax rate below that of the counties. And on that day, the city will be, let's say, 25 to 40 years from now, infinitely wealthier than the counties. But it's still a foot race to get there.
Jim, back to you. We have gone through some litigation already, and the big one that comes to mind is the Troutman-Sanders case over there in the Riverside on the James.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that project and why? I mean, I believe that was one of the first major condo office tower. I mean, it was an expensive one that utilized this program. What happened?
That was a project that was in planning, I think Lou knows this, probably about 5 years. It was at the eastern end of Browns Island. There was no clear access. The city had to come in and build a couple bridges and for access and clean up the land. They had some close to a brownfield situation on some of it. And most of it was owned by Dominion Partners, which is a subsidiary of Dominion Resources. And the opportunity was available under the current writing of the rehab ordinance that they could apply for a rehab application, and they did so on two buildings, on the condo tower, which is adjacent and attached to the office tower. The office tower actually got the main rehab application because it sits on top of an old power plant that at the time that they started construction was almost worthless. And that's the $500 value I think you referred to. The condo tower, the 10-story condo building, derived its rehab credit from an adjacent building, the old power plant, which still exists today. Because they made a small addition and attached to it, the residential condo building is considered an addition instead of a replacement building, which is the case with the office building. The office building itself is the highest valued rehab we have out of the close to 8,000, and I believe it right now sits at $55 million abatement of taxes each year. I think we're in about year six.
What does that amount to in terms of what they would be?
It's $750,000, close to it.
How many, you know, and I guess we talk about the fact that so much property is abated in such a mm-hmm. big number. I mean, if you take the 9%, I think it's 1.8 is about 9% of the total
land value. 9% of our land book. And taxable land book.
You combine that with the amount of already existing tax-exempt real estate, churches, schools, government buildings. That's close to 30%, if not a little more, of the city's property is off the tax rolls for all intents and purposes.
That's correct. It comes in several categories. We're the state capital, so we have the state buildings. We have a major university and a couple small universities of higher learning that are exempt. And then anybody that operates a nonprofit organization, of course, wants to be around the General Assembly. So we have a lot of those ownerships where they come into the city and they buy and then make application for exemption.
In a conversation with a professor at UVA a week ago about this, he kept bringing up, and this didn't make it into the story, but we're an over-reliance on the real estate tax and property tax. And that's really at the heart of what he thought the problem was. Do you agree with that, Mr. Salomonsky?
Definitely, I agree with that. Where else are you going to get the tax revenue? The sales taxes are going to the counties right now because we don't have the retail base. And the city, I guess, has no choice to be zealous in getting every crumb of tax revenue they can from real estate. Or else, and plus we have a large portion of the population that's poor and can't afford to contribute. So managing the city is a very difficult dilemma. I think the administration is doing better than prior administrations, and things are improving. And if you go to the seminars, people are not remarrying after divorce, and people are putting off getting married longer, and the percentage of married populations is shrinking, and the center city is more of a cultural center and is attracting more and more and more empty nesters. So at the end of the day, that'll help slowly balance things out, but right now it's a tight ride.
So let me just get to this, and I know this is a little bit of a sore subject, but the project that you have in Shackle Bottom and the issue being of the building, you know, it's a the ordinance, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, the intent was to encourage rehabilitation of existing property and buildings. And in your project, the small building pump house was moved from one end to the other side of the property, the southwestern side, and three of the walls were removed. Now what's left is a little sort of facade with a door cut into it. Is that really the intent of this ordinance? I mean, if that's the case, then maybe we should just scrap the requirement of it being an existing building there at all.
I don't agree that the intent was just to renovate existing buildings. The ordinance was to stimulate and make more economical new construction in the city of Richmond. And when they took off the rule that you can only add either 15 or 30% to the building, that was screaming that the program was for more than just renovating a building. So therefore, people who had the good fortune to own a shack on a piece of property had a very valuable commodity. And that valuable commodity stimulated new construction that may have never taken place in the first place. So how do you criticize that? How do you say that the policy, that this ordinance was only to renovate existing buildings? That is clearly not the case.
I need to clarify. That was the base statement of the intent of the statute in 1979. In 1995, there was a screaming demand to use it for economic development, and that's when the statute kind of took away all those limitations and basically opened it up to the localities to do whatever they wanted to do.
I agree with that statement, but it wasn't. But in 1995, they made a decision. This is not just for the renovation of an existing building.
And they added a significant change to the statute in that prior to that, it was for the renovation and restoration of buildings. They added a replacement clause so that they knew that some buildings probably would never be renovated, just wasn't financially feasible. So they created an avenue for the developer or the owner to remove the existing building and replace it with a new structure.
And what are the parameters of that? Do you get the 10 years with the replacement?
Yeah. There's in the case of multifamily, if you do a replacement building, this is just an oddball requirement that hangs out there. But if you replace a multifamily building, you can't add but an additional 30% square footage. But if you build an addition on a existing multifamily building, you can go to the ends of the earth if you have no own land out there.
Or pick it up and move it.
Or move it.
I mean, so what's the problem with this? And I mean, we just sit here, and Mrs. Salomonsky makes a great point and makes a very solid case. I mean, this is about encouraging new development, and it's doing just that, and we're bringing new residents back to the city. It's going to open up the door for retail opportunities that didn't exist before, population's up. What's the big deal?
Well, real estate tax is all about equity. So who determines what's equitable? I have no idea. You know, city council sets the standards. They adopt the letter of the law. Sometimes there's openings in the letter of the law that leads people to do things that nobody could even anticipate. And it takes somebody creative sometimes to find out where that opening is, which is the case we're talking about today. But if equity is our intent, then I think all the parties, including citizens, need to stop, analyze this, and decide for themselves whether they want this to continue on. And if everybody's happy with it and they understand what's going on, then that's just the way it'll be.
Well, Mr. Hester, why does your office constantly lobby against this ordinance in subtle ways? Why did you stimulate this article to cast aspersions on the program effectively? And you all are very open about making, what's the word I want to use, criticisms of the wisdom of this ordinance. Why not be silent completely, pass no opinion, and let council make those decisions and you just serve what the ordinance says?
Well, actually, the city council had brought up the issue in 2011. And we did an extensive report to council at that time. And after the public hearing on the situation, they just basically have let it sit on the table. It came back at this budget period, not by me, but by somebody else in administration, that as one of the things on the table that had not been closed out, and they asked council to look at it. And quite frankly, today I haven't heard from any council member. I'm sure they got opinions and they're getting advice and they have their own feelings. I don't know what those are.
Okay.
But at some point, I'm sure that it'll be addressed and then they'll either put it to bed or they'll make a recommendation for change.
Okay. Well, let's wrap this up. You know, I do want to bring up one point that we talked about, Mr. Hester, a while back. Or a couple of weeks ago, which is Petersburg. And the comparison of, if you look at Petersburg, they pretty much have what, they haven't changed the state ordinance that was put into place in 79. All of the requirements that were put in place then are still in effect in Petersburg. We're very different in the fact that we, in 95, we opened it up. How does that not play sort of into the argument that Mr. Salomonsky is making, which is, you know, okay, if we want to compare Petersburg and Richmond, you know, that's fine by me. You can clearly see Petersburg has not succeeded economically, in terms of their residential base hasn't grown like Richmond's has.
Well, we're dealing with a factor of seven difference. Richmond seven times the parcel count, the population, much larger land area. Lou's made a good point. Even in 1995, when this large set of revisions was done to the program, it still didn't kick in until about 1998. It lingered there for several years. And we have probably pushed through 15,000 rehabs since the inception of the program. Today, we're carrying on the land book. For the land book of 2013, we're carrying almost 8,000 of the 75,000 parcels under a rehab. Prior to the changes in 1995, I think we had I wasn't around, but I see the count was like 300 or 400 total from 1979 until 1996, maybe, when it started ramping up a little bit. So it obviously was not used. It wasn't recognized as being a tool other than preserving a building, and it was an incentive there if you could do it. In Petersburg, I doubt if they have processed more than 500 applications since 1980 when they instituted the program. Now, you make an allowance for the different size in the city, but that's still a large difference.
One thing to note, because of that tax, and not giving the abatement, building shells sell for around $5 a square foot in Petersburg. They sell from $30 to $40 a square foot in Richmond. So, and Richmond, of course, gets the benefit of the acquisition of that shell. That doesn't get depreciated by the abatement. So basically, the existing bricks and mortars are taking the blow of the economic deprivation of that high tax rate unabated in Petersburg right now when it comes down to that bottom line.
The last thing that I want to throw out and just get a response to is the issue of equity and what's fair. And the assessor that was here, I don't know if he was actually an assessor or deputy assessor, Mr. McKeith and I spoke.
He was the assessor for several years.
Several years. Mm-hmm. Richie McKeith mentioned this once to me, that one of the concerns is the fact that if you go into certain neighborhoods, and like Churchill or elsewhere, and you have a homeowner or a couple of homeowners get together and they fix up their property and the values increase, they don't pay the taxes. Everyone else in the community that doesn't have the ability to sort of keep up, their values are going to go up nonetheless. And they're going to get stuck paying the higher tax bill. So I get the fact that, well, yeah, values go up and their property becomes more valuable, which is a good thing. But there's some seniors who aren't in a position to take advantage of that, and they just end up having to pay higher taxes. Or you know, is that fair?
I think your question is twisted. The issue is you're only paying the taxes on the value of your improvements, and you can get an abatement on that. Everybody pays the same taxes on the basic unimproved building.
My question was, if you have two or three houses on your block and they all been fixed up and taken advantage of this abatement, the value of their properties goes up, the values next to them in your house, you didn't do anything, your value goes up and you get stuck with a higher tax bill he doesn't have to pay.
Well, it shouldn't go up, because the deprivation of the unimproved house should be recognized by the assessor. And if the homeowner would say, hey, wait a second, you can't lift me up because he's got like new next door, they'll send someone down to look at it, and very more than likely they won't raise the taxes on that person.
Is that accurate?
The characteristics of a property tends to drag the others around it, whether it goes up or down. But I don't have any way of looking at the changes that occur year to year in a neighborhood to be able to differentiate between what's just general market change or what's an increase in desirability in the neighborhood. But I would think if people are in a rehab mode in a neighborhood, that's a very good sign. And I kind of look at it a little differently. You got the people near them that really don't have to do anything to their house, but the homes being renovated nearby are actually increasing the value of their homes. And people get focused on the taxes, which is only 1% of the value. I'd much rather have that 99% than worry about the 1% that I might have to pay.
Last question for you. You actually live in one of these. Talk about that?
I live at in the Haxel Point condominiums. You can look me up. I'm in the tax rolls. I had several buying criteria. I had to live in the city, by the way, when I came to work for city council. And I wanted something that was close enough that I didn't have to move my car every day. And I wanted to be near the river, like all these other people that are coming into town. And there was the Riverside on the James sitting there with some, they'd all been sold by that time. People grabbed them up real early, but they were starting into the resale mode. And I had about three buildings that I could have bought a condo in, but I'll have to say that, to be honest, the rehab credit that I knew that would be there for another 13 years had some influence on.
But you also went to court with the neighbor, Troutman Sanders.
Oh, yeah, we're very good friends, but...
So if we... if we find your body down below in the river in a couple of years, would it be suicide or?
It wouldn't. It's right below the fastest moving rapid in the river, so it wouldn't stay there long.
Thank you very much, Mr. Salomonsky and Mr. Hester, for joining us today. This is Open Source.
Yo!
That's our show for Friday, May 10th, 2013. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts have been Chris Dovey, Scott Bass, and Brittany Tracy. The Open Source RVA producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Scardust, and our board op is the Enigmatic Manion. Thanks to Isaac Ramsey for researching and for his ombudsman skills. Mike McKenzie is the exclusive property of Mike McKenzie Industries, all rights reserved and all ankles grabbed. And we'd like to send a bouquet of kisses and a plethora of farewell hugs to our own posh spice, Ms. Amy Daniel, who departs the show this week in search of newsier pastures. We're going to miss you, Starshine. As for the rest of you, treat your mom right this Mother's Day. Be the thoughtful and informed citizen that she always wanted you to be. Go ahead and bookmark our Open Source RVA website at rvaopensource.com. Do it for Mom! We'll see you next week for another edition of Open Source RVA.